running from the frost and isolation from the South 48. We also have unique assets. We have one of our biggest problems has been and is marketing and research and processing and marketing, along with our problems with development. We're a long way from Washington, D.C., and so we don't get as much attention, I think, as some of the other states in the South 48, especially in the area of agriculture, because some people in that country think Alaska is still a land of ice and snow and can't really raise crops. The average person in the United States probably would not believe the cabbages in the Matanuska Valley unless they could actually see them for themselves. So we have some very, very serious handicaps, and the myths are just part of it. It's difficult also for us to work with other states jointly because of our isolation from them. And I think we're all aware of that concern. Of course, we are, it occurs to me that we are trying to work with Nevada in the Sagebrush Rebellion. I hope that works out. And of course, then we have a problem within the state. The people in the state of Alaska are not oriented toward agriculture. They don't think in terms of us as being a potential agricultural state. And so that's another one of the local myths that we have to get rid of. And the state, up until just recently, didn't have a very good program of promoting agricultural development. We didn't have a good homestead law. We don't have good methods of disposing of land for farming to farmers, nor do we have a method of preparing people to farm under Alaska's unique conditions. The natives in Western Alaska just recently got a grant from BIA to get involved in gardening projects to begin to teach themselves how to produce food for themselves. And at the last session of the legislature, we funded that gardening project with seed fertilizer machinery. And we traveled out there and looked at some of those projects, and there is a potential for an increased awareness in those communities of the agricultural potential that they have to have at hand. And of course, one of our big problems has been and still is how to get funding through the legislature to address the unique problems that we have. And as a result of that concern, the Ag Committee has asked these two gentlemen to come, and they're considered to be experts in that field, and we've asked him to come to show us or to try to explain. Ends up doing the research and not paying secretary salaries at the administrative level at the university in Fairbanks. And we have one very, very good thing going for us, and that is that there seems to be an increased awareness and increased concern with the legislative bodies and the willingness to put funding into agriculture at this time. I think we need to move while that interest is high. And I think it's not only confined to the legislature. I think that the average person on the street in Alaska, although they're not aware of our potential, they have a feeling for farming and are interested in seeing farm things progress. And so I think that we need to ride that little wave of interest at this time and move as rapidly as possible into developing more projects like the Delta Project. And I hope that the information these gentlemen will give us today will help us in moving ahead in that direction. Thank you very much, and I'll ask Roy Fetterman to make his presentation. Mr. Fetterman.
Right, thank you. I will go around over here in front, if I may, and so I wonder if I get you to lift this button up each time we need the slide
right.
Change.
Sure will.
Enable me to Bob. I'm able to improve this lighting just a little bit more here. We'll try anyway. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm really delighted to be here. I believe in agriculture and I believe in the United States of America, and I'm delighted that we have an opportunity here in Alaska to talk about agriculture and what we might do by way of research and education to further the cause of agriculture in this beautiful state. thought it might be interesting to you to know a little bit about where I come from in terms of the work that I do and in terms of the programs that we have, because I think establishing some credibility is always very helpful when we're talking about something as serious as we are here today. My job involves these four entities in Ohio: a College of Agriculture, Home Economics, and Natural Resources, third largest in the United States. Our enrollment, undergraduate, graduate, and two-year program last fall was 6,275 in our college, so it's a fairly decent little operation. The Research and Development Center, Ohio Agriculture Research and Development Center, one of the good ones in the country, and I would go as far as say it might be one of the good ones in the world. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. The Ohio Cooperative Extension Service, serve as director of that. We have agents in every county, where we have 10 area extension centers, four of them now located where we have research branches around the state. The whole idea is that we train people, educate them here, to get new knowledge here, distribute and disseminate that new knowledge to the people who can make use of it out in the firing line. In 1972, we added a fourth dimension, what we call our Agricultural Technical Institute, a two-year program where students are required to take 3 or 4 months of practical experience getting their hands dirty with a job. It's been a very successful program. We started out with 0 students in 1972. We have 800 students there at the present time. Next slide, please. Now for a little look at the Research and Development Center proper, which is located in Worcester, Ohio, about 90 miles northeast of Columbus. This is our entry sign, and we have the flowering crabs in bloom at this time, and the next slide will show you the campus of the Research and Development Center at Worcester, where we have 2,150 acres at that location. And we can talk a little bit more about some of those, and I'll be referring to some of the work in some of those buildings here in just a minute. Next slide, please. Our budget for the year, which ended on June 30, for the research in the Ohio Agriculture Research and Development Center, was $18.5 million. That's made up essentially of four elements. State, which is the largest element, federal, grants and contracts from either the federal government or from business and industry, and finally the sale of products that we produce in connection with the research program. Those are the four elements that we have to make up that $18.5 million. Next, please. Now just a little bit about how we divide our efforts. And I think really all you need to do is look at this first column over here. In terms of crops, we have 48.5 science years devoted to crop production. Now, that 48.5 is out of a total of about 135 full-time equivalent scientists, all of whom have the PhD. So it's a sizable faculty, and in terms of the numbers of people, it's much larger than that, but this is just the part that is not involved with resident instruction or with the extension program. This is the research part of it. We pay these people to do research, and on crops, it's 48.5 scientist years, and each scientist year in crops is $121,000. $121,000. That pays for the scientist's time or his salary. It pays for his assistants, his technical assistants, pays for his graduate student, any postdoctorals that he has, and the cost of doing the research that he does, equipment, supplies, and so forth. And in a two-year period, in the crops area, we put in $11.8 million. So it's a little, as you can see there, a little under $6 million a year on crops in Ohio. Next, please. Animals. A little bit less than that, 36.8 scientist years, but these each cost $148,000. $148,000, that's of this past year. We put again about $5.5 million into each year into research with livestock. Next. Marketing, we put 5 scientist years into that. Each of those are $119,000. And as you see here, it's not a very large, $650,000 a year. Next, please.
Jam up
in the
probably missed something, I'm not sure.
No, back her up, let's push down on the same lever. Back there, no, back there, the same lever you've been pushed up. Yeah, we missed forestry. Forestry, 6.6 SYs. That's about $122,000 a year, and about, as you see, $800,000 a year. Next. Natural resources other than forestry, primarily soil and water. Soil and water conservation management. 15.8 scientist years, and that comes out at about $130,000 a year, nearly $2 million a year going into that program. Next. People, primarily home economics, food, nutrition, textiles, clothing, and all of the other areas of home economics. 8.8 SYs, those are running currently about $120,000 a year, and as you see there, about $1 million, a little over $1 million a year. Okay. And general technology, 5.8 SYs, and about $700,000 a year. Now that's developing new technologies, new techniques, various and sundry kinds, or doing work that we really don't classify because it is maybe pure biochemistry, or it may be pure physics, or whatever. Next, please. Now, the increase that we've had from 1971 to 79 in our funding, 115.4%. And so you see from 1971 to the 73 biennium, these are by biennium, over to the biennium that just ended on June 30th, we've had a rather substantial growth in the amount of funding that we've had for the Research and Development Center. Next, please. But just as we have had that growth in our income, we've also had about the same amount of growth in the cost of equipment, or what we spent on equipment. And you see a rather steady incline, except for this one year when we had a little bit of hard times and we cut back on equipment. Next. Travel is astronomical in what's happened in the last 2 years. Nearly a 50% increase there in the last 2 years in travel. And I know that's a terrible problem for every institution. But here's the one that kills you. Utilities. Gas, electricity, and the power plant, the coal, and all the other things we use, an increase of 276% in that same period of time that our total income has gone up 115. Doesn't add up too well. Your money coming in goes up 115%, and your cost for something like utilities goes up 276% at the same time, you're in trouble. And I think we are in some trouble in terms of funding. Next, please. Now, in addition to the two main locations where we work, I guess that's right, the Ohio State University, where I have one of my offices, the Research and Development Center in Worcester, where I have my other office, we have 10 outlying branches, because you have to do research with different soil types and with different crops and different climatic conditions. And so we do research on these 10 outlying branches. Here we have what we call a muck crops, where we have high organic soils, where we do vegetable research. And we have a vegetable crops branch up here, close to Lake Erie, where we have mineral soils, and we do vegetable research there. Primarily here, it's such things as lettuce and celery and radishes and that sort of thing. And up here, it's primarily field-grown tomatoes and melons and tomatoes, that sort of business. Over here, northwest Ohio, this is where we do work on sugar beets and then corn and soybeans and alfalfa, where we have an 8-acre lysimeter field where we can measure everything that goes on those 8 acres, and everything comes off, and there's big cave water, and the water runs off. We can measure what goes into the crop, and people tell us, well, we know that you're putting on too much fertilizer, and it's running in the water, and it's polluting the underground water. We can say, well, we've got the evidence. All you've got is conversation. We've got the evidence here on an 8-acre plot to measure every bit of that. Down here in Western Branch, we have hogs and corn. It's right in the center of our largest hog area in the state. Down here we have grapes and tobacco and beef cattle, which is again an area where those crops are grown. Over here we have fruit and forestry and beef cattle. Over here is a very rough area. This is the strip mining area, and I'll show you a picture of that a little bit later. Beef cattle and sheep, and forages primarily at that location, plus strip mine research, which we've been doing now for about 30 years. Over here we have a forestry laboratory, Palm Rainforest Laboratory, and here we have soil and water with some of the most excellent lysimeters in the world at that location. It's a joint effort with the USDA at Coshocton, a place called Coshocton, and Silver's been there and can vouch for what I'm saying. We have one final one up here, Mahoning County Experimental Farm, as we call it, up east of Youngstown. So, if you're going to do research, you've got to do it in more than one or two places in the state. In the state size of Alaska, you're going to have to do it in a number of places and have outlying branches, or you might call them branch stations, whatever you like to call them. But what works in one place doesn't necessarily apply in the other. Next.
How does agriculture rank as far as an economic activity in the state of Ohio compared to, I don't know what you would compare?
Well, we have $3.5 billion worth of cash farm receipts. And the total agricultural industry, the economic, the total contribution to the economy of Ohio is estimated to be right at $12 billion. And our total contribution to gross national product is running around $55 billion. So we're $12 billion out of $55. So it's, 20% or something like that. Now, this is just to show you one of those outlying branches. I showed you the main experiment station there in that first picture, early picture. This is our southern branch where we do work on horticultural crops, on tobacco, and on grapes. And of course, here's the grape vineyard over here. And show you what could happen on a thing like that. In 1965, we decided we were going to bring the grape industry back to Ohio. One time, Ohio was the leading grape and wine producing state in the nation before they brought in disease with some of the cuttings from France. And it wiped us out back in the time of the Civil War. So we decided we're going to bring that back in, and so we started an experimental program there. We have 148 different varieties of grapes that we're working on here, experimental varieties. And we have established now wineries all across the southern counties of Ohio. We have 22 licensed wineries since 1965 as a result of that work.
How have you done that?
How we've done research and extension. First, you've got to have research in terms of the best varieties to grow. You've got to have research in terms of how to fertilize them. You've got to have research in terms of how to protect them from insects and diseases. Research in terms of the cultural practices that you have to use to get the maximum production, the type of trellis and so forth that you need for maximum production. And then you need extension to take that information out here. And we set up one-acre plots in 15 counties, 15 one-acre plots with 10 varieties in each one of them. And we help those people to learn how to be grape growers. And you've got to lead them by the hand. If you haven't done something before, you can get into an awful lot of cost of this. It costs about $500 an acre to establish this thing. You see, just the out-of-pocket that we asked the farmer. And we were putting in, we provided the cuttings because we rooted them and provided them ourselves in our own greenhouses. And we got the Myers Pump Company up in Mansfield, Ohio, to give us the spray equipment to do this thing. We got the chemical company to give us spray equipment. Because when you're trying to do something new to create wealth, a lot of people will help you. And this is what we're doing, to create new wealth. And we've created quite a lot of it in the grape wine industry in southern Ohio since 1965. Okay? This is at our Pine Rain Forest Laboratory near Coshocton, where we have a lot of our forestry research. And here you see some of our Christmas tree research work at that location. I just want to give you a few examples here and not take a lot of time. New vegetable crop branch, we bought it just 2 years ago. We'll dedicate it next week, on the 21st. The next picture will show you some of that vegetable crops work, where we have these different vegetable crops being produced.
These organic soil.
This is organic soil here now. And this I want to mention to you because each year we have what we call a farm science review. But we want to be sure that we bring everybody in the agriculture business in Ohio up to snuff in terms of what's the newest and the latest. And we team up with business and industry. They bring in all the stuff they've got to show. And we have 40 acres of exhibit area. And we harvest 450 acres of crops. And we'll, after we get a corn harvest, for example, with soybean harvest, we've got to till the soil, show them how all the different tillage instruments work, and the planting equipment, all the rest. We have 100,000 people or more there. Now, this pond here is one of three solar ponds that we have. I told some of you last night, I think I was with Kelly and Lynn, we're doing some work with solar, quite a bit of work with solar energy research. And one of them is solar ponds that we show people how to develop a source of heat with just salt water. And we'll say more about that in a minute. Okay? Now I want to just try to dramatize, if I can, that we're in the business of economic development. And you could be in the business of economic development here in Alaska. I'm convinced of it. And I want to tell you what I mean by it. Our corn crop last year was just at $1 billion. Turn the thing one more time and I'll show you what's happened. Back here in 1944, here's how many bushels of corn we produced in Ohio. A little over 140 million bushels. Last year, 380 million bushels. Now we didn't suck that out of our thumb. That happened because of research and extension and education. And I don't care what you're working about with biological material, you've got to have it. And what we do in Ohio will not fit in Alaska. What we do in Michigan will not fit in Alaska except for certain elements of it. But a big part of it has got to be done where you have the soils and you have the climate You have all the elements that are unique to that situation when you're dealing with biological material. It can be done, and it's fabulous. You take the difference in there between that 240 million bushels, you multiply it by $3 a bushel, and that, you can multiply it any figure you want, but that's not too bad for this year. And you see we're talking about $720 million of new wealth that wouldn't have been in Ohio without it. Each one of those dollar new wealth turns over in the economy 3 to 5 times. So you're talking about a lot of good on Main Street to everybody that's in business. Next, please. Here's another, soybeans. This is 1977 figure, $659 million. Last year, $801 million. This year, we'll be over $1 billion in soybeans. You go back to the end of World War II, and I'll show you that in the next picture. Here's where we were on soybean production in Ohio, 20 million bushels. Here's where we are now, 120 million. Actually, last year, this is 1977 chart. Actually, last year, 132 million acres, or bushels. 132 minus 20, is 112 million bushels, and $7 a bushel, that's another $700 million in new wealth. You know, it just didn't happen. We probably would have been wiped out of soybeans if we hadn't developed varieties that had the capability to resist Phytophthora root rot, because it's a very bad disease in Ohio, particularly, and it works the same way over in northern Indiana, and you have a little of it in your place too, Sylvan. But the protection from those diseases, the new varieties, we're working on 2,000 genotypes. Soybeans. 2,000 of them. New ones. We're coming on with them. We grow them down in the Central America in the summer, in the wintertime. Summertime, we produce them up in Ohio, and we're also working on them in the greenhouse. It takes about 10 to 12 years to bring on a new variety. We just released one new variety 2 years ago. We released another new variety this year. Each of them is going to be worth probably anywhere from 4 to 7 bushels to the acre. Now, 4 to 7 bushels to the acre on nearly 4 million acres times $7 is a lot of money, about $30 million a year. $30 million a year from one of these new varieties. New wealth, no question about it. And it comes out of research and education. Because it wouldn't do a bit of good to do the research and put it on the shelf. I saw that in India when I went there in 1962. See that in a lot of places in the world. When they do the research, they have very, very fine research, but they write it up in the book, in a book and put it on the shelf. It never does get out the farmer. It never does get out the industry. It doesn't do anybody any good, particularly, except, you know, it pays the guy that's doing research, I guess, but that's about it. Next, please. Tomatoes, we have about $30 million worth of field growing tomatoes in Ohio. Next, please. And here again, what's happened? Total production. From back here in 44 up to the present time. What happened here? We had strikes. It's harvest time. What do we have to do? We had to mechanize. And so we have now, in just the past year, sold 110 new mechanical harvesters for harvesting those field tomatoes, and this year that line's going back up again. We can grow about 3 tons of tomatoes per acre, and it's a darn good crop. Next, please. Cucumbers. $9 million, 1977, $12 million last year, it's going to be up again this year. Mechanical harvesting. Mechanical harvesting. Let's look at the next one here. Here again, what's happened to total production? 1954. This is only 20 years change in the thousands of tons, from 10 up to 80 in that period of time, 20 years. Again, it will not happen without research, because the varieties we're growing are varieties we produce through the research. The varieties are unique to Ohio, that will work in Ohio under our conditions, have the resistance to the diseases we have, resistant insects, and so forth. The fertility program goes along with it, and all the rest of it. Even the cultural practice where we now plant these on beds. You plant a raised bed here, where you plant 2 rows of tomatoes, and then you leave a furrow here so the water can run off, and then you have another bed. And the nice part about that is you go to harvest them if you happen to have a wet year, which we might very well have this year since it ran so much already. You've got to be able to dry that out up there. We've got to do the harvesting, you see, and you can do that with that kind of a bedding technique. Again, it's research, the application of that research. Next,
Dr. Kaufman, yes. I notice on a number of these crops that there's a dip down in 1959. What happened there?
Well, I don't know. That's the year before I came to Ohio. I don't know what happened. There's always a dip. I didn't know there was a one in 59.
Well, there wasn't always, but on a number
of crops. Well, it probably was the droughty year, would be my guess. Another crop that we do a lot of research on, production of flowers in greenhouses, now $60 million wholesale value. And next slide, please. And again, you see what's happened to the total value of that over this period, 1949 up to here we stopped in about 1970. Next, please. Nursery products, about $50 million at the wholesale value. Next. And here I just show the number of acres because I didn't have the data on that thing. We just don't have it available. And here are the acres. There's a little slump in here. And again, I'm not sure about that. So why that happened, but here it's going back up again. Now, this is just a little bit, I want to show you some of our facilities. That's our dairy research facility at Worcester. It's the main station. We just completed, dedicated it just a year ago as a Friday, this coming Friday. $2.5 million dairy research unit. We have 220 milking cows there and a lagoon for the handling of the liquid part of the waste. And we have automatic cleaners here, and we have one of those machines that squeeze the juice out of the manure, and then we use that dry product again to bed the cattle in the barn. Our work in veterinary science involves a lot of what we call notobiotic work or germ-free work, where we take the baby animals, whether it's pigs or whether it's lambs or whether it's calves, directly from the uterus of the mother. They never have any contact with air. They're put in this plastic container here, and everything that's put in there is purified so that they, when you test them against a disease organism, you know that what happens to them is because of that disease organism and nothing else. Now, germ-free research, we do a very large, we're just building a new $1.5 million germ-free laboratory right now. Next, please. One of the interesting bits of research we've done in recent years has to do with different areas of the light spectrum on incubation of eggs. And it's very interesting work because we're finding that blue light, for example, will increase the weight of the chickens when they're born, about 6%. This color light up here, the reddish-yellow light, will reduce the length of hatching time by a day and a half. Now, if you're doing a few million chicks, as some of these large producers are, those two elements get to be very, very important elements. And there's some other very interesting things there that have to do with premature human infants and everything else. We're working jointly with the College of Medicine on that particular project. We're working on exotic breeds of all kinds of livestock that we can get the USDA to let us import in the country. This is the St. Croix breed of sheep from down the St. Croix in the Virgin Islands. This is the Barbados breed of sheep, which is another hair type sheep, and of course the regular down breed of sheep from Britain. And we're trying to improve the taste, the flavor of sheep meat. We're also trying to get away from any wool at all, because just breed them for the meat alone. And so we're bringing in some of these exotic varieties. We brought in the Finnish Landrace breed about 6 or 8 years ago. And that's got the capability of increasing the number of lambs born from what was running about 1 to 1.1 number of lambs per year for you or for the time of lambing. And we're up now over 2 because we're bringing in the Finnish Landrace breed. And they have actually litters. They'll have as many as 3 or 4 sometimes. If you bring in exotic germplasm, you do a lot, but it takes you years to get through selection. And that's what we try to do, bring in exotic germplasm and change the nature of these breeds for whatever. The other thing we're working on here is parasite resistance, because these have a lot better internal parasite resistance than the down breeds of sheep. This just gives you a little idea of some of our greenhouse work. This is the field tomato research, where we're starting here new crosses, new genetic material, some of which we got from Peru. Get a lot of the disease resistant stuff in tomatoes out of the country of Peru. And here you see some of the early crosses that the records have made. And this is our chief breeder, Stan Berry, in charge of the greenhouse tomato work. And this is a little interesting thing. Our ag engineers have perfected a sorter that will sort green and ripe tomatoes and pick the rocks out of potatoes, and it will sort green and ripe apples and a few other things. And what it is they have this central cylinder here that's just slightly off-center, so it has a little vibration as it rotates. And when it rotates against a green or against a rock, that's more solid. It'll pop them off to the side, and the ripe ones come on through, or the potatoes will come on through, and the rocks go off. And we've got that patented, and it's going to make some money already. This is one of the developments we've had in recent years. It's telling the girls about it last night, Lynn and Kelly, where we put inflated plastic over the top of ordinary glass greenhouses, and you put air between that, and you have a little space of air about like so. And that just that insulation of the air has reduced the amount of heat required by 57%. Now that's about $24,000 an acre saved. And we have 650 acres of greenhouses in Ohio. So if you save 24,000 times 650 acres, you save a lot of energy.
Yeah. One question I got. Is it possible to put that completed deal on the inside of the greenhouse deal? I'm thinking about smoke cover.
Yeah. Well, this is really one of the serious problems, is getting that snow off of there. Where frequently we have banks of these greenhouses, you know, they may run over here where you got somebody's got 10, 12 acres of greenhouses, and you have them right together, and you've got just one up against the other. How are you going to get rid of that snow unless you got enough heat to melt it? That's kind of a problem. And I don't know how we're going to solve that one exactly. But that, we've gotten by all except that one bad year, 2 years ago, when we had so darn much snow.
And it was just doesn't matter whether it's inside the glass or outside the glass.
No, that wouldn't matter. Okay. Next, please. Now, the next step in that is we have blown polystyrene beads between those layers of plastic at night. And that gives you a thick layer of insulation there, extra insulation through the night hours. And that saves up to 90% of your total heat. Now, you see, if I keep going on this, you can save more heat than we actually use to start with. So it doesn't go that far, unfortunately. But this will save about $36,000 per acre per year. Now, I mentioned earlier the solar pond, and this is at Worcester again, our research and development center. And this is our ag engineering, this is our agronomy building over here, ag engineering sits over here. This is a solar pond, 8.5 feet deep, 40 feet long, about 20 feet wide. And what you do is you put in layers of salt solution with a heavy concentration of salt in the bottom and then lesser concentration in the next layer. And you put that in there very gently and very carefully, and they don't mix, believe it or not. They don't mix. So there's heavy concentration of salt in the bottom. And as the sun's rays come in, they get trapped down there and they get very warm. And we get up to 170 degrees there this summer so far in the bottom layer of salt in that thing. We have a heat exchanger down in the bottom of that, bring heat over to these greenhouses to heat the greenhouses in through the wintertime. And another heat exchanger arrangement with a fan behind it to blow the heat out here in the greenhouse. Now we're doing another thing in those same greenhouses. Maybe some interest in taking, we're taking hot water, such as you get from a cooling tower with a electric generating plant. And we're putting those pipes in the bottom in the soil to heat the greenhouse through the soil and finding some rather startlingly good results with the additional heat in the root zone for the plants growing in the greenhouse. Next, please. Now, this is a field of potatoes, and I mentioned that only because I know you are interested here. We don't have a large potato industry in Ohio. I get to grow about 14,000 acres is all, so it isn't all that great. But we do some research on it, and I said earlier to somebody at lunch today, we try to serve all people. That's what Land-Grant University is for. That's what the good word that President Lincoln signed back on July 2nd, 1862 said. You know, it's for... We're going to have an educational system for the sons and daughters of the working classes. And it's going to be applied, it's going to be practical to get to serve the people. And that's what we try to do. Next. And we have a lot of food processing research and potato chips. Getting the best kind of chipping quality is another thing we do pretty well. Next. And this is another thing we've done recently where we take artificial soil and then these little drip tubes here, this drip irrigation, and we're growing greenhouse tomatoes without putting them down and without putting roots in the soil. We just use a bag of stuff that has all the mineral nutrients in it you need, a little drip irrigation, and you can grow a whole crop of tomatoes there very, very nicely. You don't have to worry about disease because you can sterilize this when you put it in there, and you can sterilize it again if you want to later put in more nutrients, do a lot of interesting things. Also do a hydroponic work that way where you just keep a steady flow of water with mineral nutrients in it and grow these same tomatoes in greenhouse. And I mentioned the honeybees earlier, and Pappy, you were interested in honeybees. It is a large industry, with $2 million a year in terms of the sale of honey. But again, we have research and we have extension. And we also teach this in API, AgTech Institute. We have one of the few programs to teach people how to handle and work with honeybees and produce honey. Next. This is rather an interesting piece of research because here we have 32 of these 1/100th of an acre lysimeters. We got into this work here right after World War II when we were concerned about fallout from strontium 90 when the Chinese primarily were doing all of their dirty bombs in the air. We were getting a lot of fallout coming over to the U.S. that time, and we were getting enough of them in Ohio. So we built these things so that the fallout goes in there, and we could tell exactly what happens. The fallout of the strontium 90 go down into the groundwater because we bring that in here, you see, or does it run off in the runoff water? Does it go into the plant? And if it goes in the plant, where does it go in the plant? And we found, much to our delight, that the corn kernel has zero strontium 90. Now the rest of the corn plant has in there very badly, the stalk and the husk and everything else. The kernel itself has zero, so blue never goes up and we have nothing around it. Standing corn. Protect yourself while you husk it back and go ahead and eat your turnips. Anyway, that's not what we use them for now. We use that those things now for fertilizer studies. Because of all this noise we've had over in Illinois, particularly about we're polluting the groundwater with putting on too much fertilizer, and we're going to blue babies and all that sort of stuff. And so we're using nitrogen 15, which is a labeled labeled product that we can measure exactly what happened in all the different crops. And you put on different amounts of nitrogen or phosphorus or potash, you measure what happens to it, and you know exactly what's going on and don't have to guess about it. Next please. I told you we're doing strip mine research at our Eastern Ohio Resource Development Center, which is one of our outlying branches. And this is the way the land looks when they're doing the strip mining research. And we had lots of people tell us for a long, long period of time we've been doing strip mining research ever since the end of World War II. We've done a heck of a lot of lysimeters and everything else. We found there are only three ways you can cure this problem. Number one, you have to stockpile the topsoil and then put it back on after you get it leveled off. Number two, you can put on sewage sludge after you get it leveled off. Number three, you can take fly ash from electro-generating plant and put on and get through. Any one of them will do a great job. Here's what it looks like, next slide, after you get it reclaimed. And we'll show you 1,000 acres on how it looked that good. As a matter of fact, we planted no-till corn in some of this land down for each of the last 3 years. And we've gotten as high as 136 bushels of corn to the acre on land that has been reclaimed only 2 years earlier. So you see, it will do a job. And the land is better than it was before we strip mined it. Because before that we had deep ravines, we had gullies, we had erosion. Now we can level it off, we can get it in good shape, you can get over with farm equipment, and you can really do a job that you couldn't do before. With the strip mining, we got the coal out of there, which is worth many millions of dollars. We got land better than we started with. Next.
What do you do about the heavy metals when you put on the sludge from the waste treatment plant?
We have a soils testing laboratory at the Research Development Center where we have equipment to test the sludge, and we take regular samples or ask the communities that are selling this or giving it away or whatever to take regular samples of the sludge so that they will know that they're not putting on heavy metals. Now we've got some cities that we just told them there's no way you can put that on. And Zanesville, one of them, 60 miles east of Columbus. And I don't know where the darn stuff's coming from, but somebody somewhere is slipping a lot of manganese into that thing, and more than we want. So we're saying, no, don't use that. And we'll have some others, the heavy metals, that's not heavy metals, we have some other heavy metals that, you can't use. But most of them, we've got 132 cities in Ohio right now. They're putting out their sewage sludge and putting it on farmland and doing a great job because it's got fertilizer elements in it. Good way to get rid of it. Everybody profits.
Well, Cleveland bagged it 40, 50 years ago and sold it.
Milwaukee, they'll organize, for ages.
But it seems like such a very valuable resource. And then to have this heavy metals problem, and seem like you might be able to use it on forest land or something like that, where it's not a...
Well, what you'd have to have is a system of testing it, and if there's heavy metal, you've got to trace down where that heavy metal's coming from, and then eliminate that source.
Are you involved in any of that?
Well, the EPA, Ohio EPA, is the one that traces them back. All we do is report it. And here is a sample with heavy metal in it. We have a memorandum of agreement. I just signed it the day before I came up here. With the Ohio EPA, and we work with them on this thing on a regular basis. We do the testing of the sludge or the analysis of it, send in the results, and then they follow up on enforcement. That's the other thing that's terribly important. And it's a thing you observe all around the world. They made a mistake, primarily the British system. Made a mistake because they put in the same pot. They put the research, the extension, and the enforcement all in one organization, the State Department of Agriculture. It's a great idea, but it won't work.
You ought to take the enforcement out.
Because you keep the enforcement out of it. Otherwise, you got people say, well, oh, so-and-so, if I do anything here, I'm going to be in trouble. I'm going to be in court. And so they don't care about your new information. They won't accept it. They won't deal with you. So you keep those separate, research and education, from the enforcement. We've learned that in this country, and that's the way we generally do it. But many places in the world, they haven't learned it yet. Now, just very quickly here, the research that we do, the fertilization research in the United States, we divide into four regions. The North Central region, where Alaska is a part of it. And that's why we're here and why Jim Drew and some of these people come down and meet with us while we come up and hold meetings here in Alaska. The Western region, they have Hawaii thrown in the Western region. Southern region has Puerto Rico. They don't show it here. I don't know why. Because it's not a state, I guess, is the reason they haven't shown it. The Northeast region is up in this area. Now, each of those regions, of course, we have what we call regional research. So we know with the technical committees that are organized that we aren't doing a lot of unnecessary duplication. And we also know that we're covering the important things that need to be covered. If you're dealing, doesn't matter what you may be dealing with, whether it's a crop or whether it's livestock or livestock products, you want to do all the things you should do, but you don't want to do anything that's unnecessary. And so by this arrangement, we can do that. And we also have an organized planning and coordinating structure that is national in scope, and it ties together these four regions, and it is regional in the scope, because within each of the regions, we know what's going on, and we have this research that goes across all of the states in the region. And of course, at the state level, we have our mechanisms for coordination. And of course, we also have commodity groups that are interested in helping us plan. And we plan some by scientific topic as well, by commodity. So we have a very elaborate, a very useful plan. And then we have a national system, what we call the CRIS system. And that is the Current Research Information System, CRIS, that we can ask them at any time, what's going on with this crop, or what's going on in terms of the physiology of that crop, or what's going on in terms of the genetics of that crop, or what's going on in terms of the insect protection of that crop, or what's going on with the diseases of that crop, and get an answer for the whole United States, all of the USDA research, and all of the state station research. So we don't have to duplicate, we don't have to have areas that are left untouched that ought to be worked on. It's a very good system. Next. Now here's, I think, probably the most important piece of information I'll give you today. We've illustrated research as a spigot with new discoveries coming out of it. You note here that since 1950, we've had more discoveries in agriculture than we had in all recorded history prior to that time. That's what extension builds on and farmers use, this new knowledge, all about crops and livestock. But the thing I want to leave you with is not all that I just said. You cannot turn research on and off like a faucet when you're dealing with agriculture or biological sciences. Why? You're going to have a new soybean variety. It takes you 10 to 12 years to produce it. If you've got a three-year project, forget it. You've got to have constant funding, dependable funding. You can hire people. You can give them tenure. They can work at it. They can devote their lives to it and be proud of what they're doing, and you hold them responsible for what they're doing. You cannot turn research on and off like a water faucet, which so many people out in Washington don't understand or appreciate, including the National Science Foundation to a very large extent. You've got to have continuity. And that's why this system, that's why we have the most efficient agriculture in the world. That's why the charts I was showing you, Phil will show you the same thing for his state, the crops that he grows there. And what we do in Ohio doesn't necessarily fit in Michigan. Some of it does, sure, half or better money, but a lot of it wouldn't. You cannot have intermittent funding. Say, well, we'll give you a pot of money, you work on this thing, 3 years later, while the money's gone and somebody else has chased a new star over here, and you don't have any money to continue. It's got to be the base of it. It's got to be hard money, as we call it. And we've had that for years through the Hatch Act, passed 1887 by the Congress, and through our state experiment station, which at least match it. Matter of fact, they're matching now about 3-1, a little better than 3-1.
You mean Ohio's matching 3-1?
Yes, sir. We match it better than 3-1. But that's quite a bit better than 3-1, but nationally that's about what it is. Our match at the present time is about 5-1.
Question on your research fund. What sort of relationship do you have in the legislature with the state as far as what is the atmosphere, what is the climate with them? Do you have any problems getting research money, or are they pretty well
involved? Well, normally I'd say we don't have much to know. It's just a matter that you've got 11 million people in Ohio, and you've got 97,000 farmers, and I think we probably have our fair share of those farmers in the legislature, but, you know, that's won't be too many. I think we've got, you know, four or five bona fide farmers in the legislature.
Can you give me any idea about, maybe not completely in research, but can you give me any idea how much money you're talking about the state legislature fund your research programs with?
Yeah.
Each year, I'm talking about.
Okay. We've got $18.5 million for our budget last year, and the state funded approximately $13 million of that.
Okay, and the rest of it was federal grants?
Federal grants and the sale of byproducts from the research and the federal formula.
Right. Now, this is in research alone. Do you have any idea how much state funding there is available to the farming industry?
Well, of course, they have they support the Department of Agriculture, which is a regulatory agency, and I think their budget is somewhere around $9 or $10 million a year, and they have a few programs, such as support for the purebred livestock industries, that they put in $500,000 for each of the three different species a year. Didn't much from that standpoint.
Well, you're talking about then on a regular basis, you're looking at probably $30 million a year in the farming industry.
On a regular basis, we're looking at, in terms of research and extension, pretty close to $30 million a year that we get regularly, and we've never been cut yet. History, and I don't expect it will be. We maybe not keep up with inflation, which is the problem in recent years, but that's what we're looking at on ongoing funding. And with that, the return on the investment that we've had in Ohio is running about 35%, according to the best calculations we can make.
Okay, one more question. Basically, most of your charts and so forth showed the inflation you've got here starting about 47, 48, in relation to the amount of funds you were getting now, about what was the funding that you were getting at that period of time? The reason I ask the question is I see us about 30 to 40 years behind what you're doing now.
Yeah, the funding back up until, say, 1948 would have been very meager. It was less than $1 million for each of research and extension.
All right, but the point is, once the state started getting into the picture with funding and aid, then you began to really develop the
We began to move things. We moved from 45 bushels of corn to the acre, state average, in 1946 to over 100 bushels an acre in each year. And, that's a tremendous move. 240 million bushels. $720 million a year. In soybeans, we moved from about 16, 17 bushels of soybeans to acre to 34 bushels, which we've had each of the last recent years. And that again would be $500 million.
What's your farm size in Ohio?
Average farm size in Ohio is not very large, about 179 acres.
Yeah, I know it's only 320 in Iowa.
So the average doesn't tell you much. You know, the story about average is where you stand with 1 foot in the bucket of ice water and the other in the bucket of boiling water, and the average you're comfortable. That's about the way it is with those average farm size figures. They really don't tell you much. But I'd say most of our commercial farms are 400 acres or bigger. And there are very few that are above 1,000. 400 to 1,000 catch most of our commercial farms. Okay? So this is just a little schematic again about our state experiment stations and the whole idea of public research, where you have the USDA and you have the private research, and they feed this information to the Department of Extension Service from the state experiment station, goes over to the farm newspapers and radio and television and a lot of other groups that help you, and you get it over here to the public and your consumers and your urban citizens, the farmers, food processors, industries all use this information. Next, please. And then there's a feedback mechanism from these same people. They feed back. They need it. They got a problem. And seldom a week goes by and I don't have a group in my office to say we want more help on this, that, or the other thing. And I guess the most recent group I had in my office was a group from the fruit industry. We were complaining we aren't doing enough research and extension on fruit. And the week before that, we had the people in there on the swine industry saying we weren't doing enough work there. And I had to agree with both of them. Because we aren't, because the potential is there. And it's a little bit like Boss Kettering. He used to be, Vice President of General Motors, and has 200 and some inventions to his credit. He used to be on the Board of Trustees at Ohio State University, and I remember at a cocktail party one evening, I asked him about this, and somebody said, well, you've done a lot of work with aerodynamics. He said, what's the story about this thing? And he said, oh, that's not very complicated. He said, you put in a car on the kitchen table and fly. And that's about the way it is here. You decide what you want to do. Put some money into it, it'll go. You know, we got example after example after example. Next. The research investment yield, this is a study done by Dr. Siebert, University of California, and Bobby Edelman down at the Mississippi State University in 1977. And they studied 30-year history on this thing, and they found out that with beef, the average return on investment was 17% per year. On soybeans, 31%, on corn, 32%, on poultry, 34%, on dairy, 38%, on wheat, 46%, on swine, 52%, on potatoes, 110%. It was a bad problem. This is just another comparison where you compare the yield on investments of various kind, and over here you've got municipal bond. This, of course, is tax-free, so that 5% looks a lot bigger than that. And the next is BLB7, long-term savings for preferred stocks. That give you about 8%, depending what kind of CD, 4 years, 8 years, whatever. Utility bonds, you might get that kind of money out of, that kind of return on them. Beef research, 17, these are the same figures I had before, soybeans and corn. Just show that we're talking about investment. We're not talking about spending money, not talking about pouring down a rat hole. We're talking about an investment. We're talking about agriculture research. Just a little example of that from Minnesota, where their corn increases here over a period of time, 15 bushel to acre. That's good. Soybean increases 5 bushel to acre. Wheat increases 9 bushel to acre. And they totaled up what they put in their pesticide research and the cost that they'd had over a period of years, and I've forgotten just what number of years was. They spent $118 million on this, but the benefits were $349 million. And besides that, they saved $10 million worth of fuel, because a lot of this was with no-tillage, where you substitute pesticide for tractor fuel to do all the different tillage to control the weeds and all that. Pretty good specific example. Here's one of the things that worries us at the federal level, because for each dollar that the federal government spends on agricultural research, they're spending $5.07 for health, education, welfare, $6.52 for energy research, $6.71 for the National Space Administration, and $19.87 on military research, and on transportation, $0.59, 54 cents Interior Department, and 45 cents on commerce. And, you know, we like to show them this picture here because we think here's something that's really productive. Most of the others, many of the others, you're spending money, and there's one that's productive. Okay? And this is what that same picture really says at the federal level. We're a lot worse off than we were back here in 1966. When you convert the dollars that we've gotten for the state experiment stations from the federal government into constant value dollars, the number of them goes right down here. So we had $47 million constant value dollars. Well, this is 100% 66, and we're down here now at about $39 million of those same constant value dollars. So we're going forward in reverse in terms of federal funding for agricultural research. And here, all the people in Washington, I've never heard so many people eulogize agriculture as I've heard in the last 5 or 6 years. It's going to save the world. You know, we buy all the fuel we need for the agricultural exports. We have $32 billion worth of ag exports this year estimated, possibly 33, 29 last year. And, you know, we're buying about $50 billion worth of fuel. Well, if you take $32 billion against 50, that pays for a big chunk of it. And yet, by golly, we have a tough time getting research for something we can show them, we can demonstrate. It's so self-evident that it shouldn't even take any discussion. But it's going in the wrong direction in terms of funding at the federal level. Next. Well, I'm going to end here on hopefully something that interests to you. We have a 7.5-acre rhododendron azalea garden at the Research Development Center, and this is a pretty picture from that. I'll show you that next. We also have a 3.5-acre rose garden, Legend and Romance, and we got roses there, these old roses. These are not the modern tea roses. These go back to the time of Alexander the Great and of Cleopatra and some of those people. We have 500 different varieties, and 3 plants of each variety. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing. The second week in June, if you're ever in Ohio, and I show it to you. And finally, since we do play a little football at Ohio State, I thought I'd show you the Ohio Stadium, holds 87,000 people, Scripps, Ohio, being performed during intermission or during the halftime. And finally, I just want to tell you, on behalf of the Ohio State University, I consider it a very great honor to have been invited here to talk with you about research for agriculture. Thank you very much.
We'd like to allow you all to have access to Dr. Carvin. If you have any questions, I'd like you to ask him now.
Yeah, I've got some questions, but I can't figure out where to start. I'm an employee of the Department of U.S. Department of Agriculture, and I find the same frustration that you do within the department for not having adequate research. The frustration ran so high that I tried to encourage one person, or I suggested that they might, and I can't be bothered. We just might as well not have any research in some of our areas in the way that it's been treated in the department. Now, do you feel that the recent change, Science and Education Administration being elevated in effect to an assistant secretary level, reporting directly to the secretary, do you think that's going to make any difference?
Well, I hope it will, but I don't see much difference there until Howard Yard is out of there. Howard Yard is the assistant secretary in charge of the budget. Howard Yard clumped his PhD exam down in North Carolina. He's been mad at the land grant system ever since, and he's not about to get any money. I don't expect it to change much long Howard's there. Now, that's being brutally frank, but that's where the problem is.
Another question with respect to what made Ohio decide, up until 1948, you said it had been very meager support by the state. Then Ohio apparently had a change of attitude and started contributing heavily to the research system that you've just described.
Well, I think there are a couple of reasons for that. One is the federal government really helped out mightily up through World War II.
Mm-hmm.
It was agriculture was by far the largest part. 40% of the federal budget for research went to agriculture in 1940.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's down around 1%. So it was, as the federal government failed to move forward with agriculture research, I think the people in the states concluded it was a good investment and they were going to put money in it.
Now, do you, has that been paralleled? Where do you figure Ohio fits in all of this? Ohio is a state that's generally looked at nationally as an area of substantial manufacturing concern with an agricultural mix. It's always had a heavy...
That's one of the best mixes I know about.
Yeah, and in this end, the economic cycles are therefore not quite so
that's
tough
right.
in Ohio
right.
because of this mix.
Right.
Well now, where does Ohio then rank nationally as far as putting money into research from the state level?
Pretty well.
Upper third at least, upper 10% of the states?
I would suppose upper third is a good place for it. We're not the best in terms of putting money in.
Who do you think is the best?
Well, I suppose we always have to look to California because they put in $37, $38 million last time I looked at it, state money into their research.
$37 or $38 million. Of course, their agriculture is the largest.
Yeah, they're three times, profit. Their cash farmers each three times what ours are. And so we put in $13 million, and I put in $38. It's pretty much the same. I'd say we're, given...
You might even be doing a little better.
We might.
Mm-hmm.
But Sylvan does a lot better than I do in terms of cash farm receipts and the support he gets from the state.
I'm interested in the system for your getting money
mm-hmm.
that you have. I assume it goes to the state legislature
yes.
as well.
Yes.
I assume it's a line item.
Yes.
Yes.
We make our request to the Board of Regents, and the Board of Regents makes its recommendation to the Governor's office. And the Governor makes his recommendation to the General Assembly, and the General Assembly then makes the appropriation.
Mm-hmm.
So I imagine it's exactly the same here.
Does the university administrative adjustments or does your initial request follow along, or does...
Well, you see, we're rather unique in Ohio in the Research Development Center because we're a separate legal entity, and we're unique, and yet we aren't, because the Board of Trustees of the Ohio State University is the same as the Board of Control for the Research and Development Center, except when the Board of Control meets, the State Department of Agriculture director sits with them. So it's a 9-man board for the university, it's a 10-man board for the Research Development Center. It's the same people except for one. And so that we have to clear our budget request with that group. So, it's not too different than going through the president of the university, but it's quite a little different than that because we do have access, a little more access directly with the board because of our legal entity setup. But we still have to clear our own board of control and then go from there on over to the Board of Regents, which is overall for all institutions in the state. And they make their decision. And unfortunately, I never found any of those boards that increased the amount of money that you asked for. They always find a way to decrease it all along the line. So you start off here, what you think you honestly need and could use, and then it goes downhill from there. usually. Until you get to the General Assembly, then I can usually get it built up again, which I do regularly, which bothers some people.
You don't have a problem, though, of establishing a priority for your research system and then having the university administration say that that is not a priority.
No, sir.
Not appear before the legislature.
No, sir. We don't have that.
Now, if I heard you correctly, the reason you don't have that is because you're a separate entity, even though the same people make the decision as to which money is asked for.
Well,
once the decision is made, it goes directly to you rather than to the other.
Yes and no. Generally speaking, experiment station directors across the country do not have that problem of being second-guessed by the president's office. And I think the reason for it is that the Hatch Act law is pretty clear, and the interpretation of it by the by the office of the OIG in Washington is such that they take a dim view, and the Congress takes a very dim view also of taking anything away from the prerogatives of the director, who is officially appointed and recognized at the USDA and by the Congress and by the National Association of State University and Land-Grant Colleges. So that in most of the institutions, you don't have any second-guessing of the director by the president. Now, you may have in terms of the level that is being asked for, but in terms of what you're going to do within that, very little of that, and I think still can bear that out.
I think, Roy, that's certainly the case in the sense that the experiment station directors are all free to manage what money they get with respect to the way they perceive it being best managed, particularly in view of the mix of federal and state money that goes into the experiment station program. The problem, I think, in Alaska is, or one of the problems is, that there never really has been a fully developed agriculture within the state. Consequently, there is no real thrust on the part of university administrations to perceive agriculture as being anything that would require anything special in terms of research concern. And so, consequently, during a period of just basically maintenance funding that the university has been under for the past 3 or 4 years, the agricultural research program has just barely held its own in terms of inflationary increases, in spite of the fact that the state itself, through legislative appropriations for agricultural development, has moved ahead substantially on the order of some $12 million or so during the past couple of years. So the problem here is that the state legislature has had difficulty in getting the university administration to respond to needs for research, which have been brought about by the very active development that the state legislature itself has met through the increased appropriations for development.
It's a chicken and egg proposition, too, because in the state where these programs are well-developed and well-funded, if I didn't ask for the money, I'd have a lot of people with a gun in my back. I'm talking about the industry out here would say, what the hell's the matter with you? You aren't asking for the money we need to make this industry go. And we've got, for example, a research council of 200 people that meet regularly. And they carry the ball with the legislature. And if we need to put on something for the legislature, take some of the money, they dig it out of their pockets. This is important to them. This is money in their pockets.
You see, I think that's very significant. The point is that you have a user group,
right,
which is very receptive to the material and information that comes from your program and recognizes that that information is in fact key to the economic success of whatever it is that they're doing.
Right.
In Alaska, we don't have that.
Yeah, well, you see,
you're
building it up, but it takes a while.
That's right. But what we're looking for, you see, in the meantime, is a mechanism in order to provide the necessary research and extension components that we need to build this infant industry. What, in essence, we are dealing with economically is an infant industry.
Right.
And no infant industry can survive in direct competition with a mature,
right,
industry. It has to have some sort of basic support which would not come otherwise. When Pappy Moss was asking you, for example, about what the levels of state funding for research were in Ohio, I couldn't help but sit here and think that you were really kind of almost on two different wavelengths, because Pappy was talking about the infant industry of agriculture in Alaska. You were talking about an agricultural industry in Ohio that's been fully developed for 100 years. And so consequently, much of the funding that the legislature has done for agriculture in Alaska, really for the past several years, but particularly in the past 2 years, has been aimed at actual development activities, nuts and bolts things like getting land cleared, No, I don't suppose you worried about clearing land in Ohio for some time.
Curiously, we did have a little study on that back in 1965, because we took over that place that I showed you with all that strip mining, and we had a lot of undergrowth, small trees, just stuff that was, you know, worthless. And so we had a project where we evaluated the cost of reclaiming that land, cleared the trees off of it with different kinds of techniques, the largest bulldozers we could get, down to doing it with a man or two men with a chainsaw and an axe and so forth, and burning it off and all these different things, compare the cost of it. So we have had a little bit of that, but not very much.
Sure. That's right.
I might say that 1940-48, that's where we're trying to get two men on the wavelength. I think Jim caught what I was talking about.
But see, that's
just what I was trying to get tied in was you were then probably further ahead even at that point than we are even now. And that's why I was trying to get the relationship and the funding and so forth.
So the point is that the funding that the legislature here in Alaska has provided for agriculture in the past few years has been aimed directly at development. I suppose it's been a long time, for example, since the state legislature in Ohio appropriated money to build a road to a farm. You see? And yet that's the key thing that we need in order to get the farm started. I expect it's been a long time since the legislature in Ohio appropriated money to get electrical power to a farm. You see? And yet that's the stage that we're in at the present time. It's been a long time since the state legislature appropriated funding for financing for something like the construction of a grain elevator, I suspect, you see. And yet that's where we are. With your fully developed agriculture, you have a private financing system that handles the basic year-to-year financing needs, and you have an infrastructure with respect to roads, power, and so on that's been in place for a long time. Now, we don't, and that's why... So when you were talking about funding that the Ohio State Legislature provides for agriculture each year, you were talking primarily about funding for research and extension. You see, whereas when we talk about funding that the legislature has provided for Alaska in the past couple of years, you know, the greatest share of it has gone not for research and extension, but for just getting the basic elements of the infrastructure started, for getting the land cleared and the roads and so on.
I'd like to interrupt a little bit. We have 2 o'clock tomorrow. We're going to get involved in kind of a roundtable discussion. We can stick to any specific questions about presentation, because we want to keep moving our timetable here. Does anyone have any specific questions about how to present?
I've got one more that I want. What is the funding mix that you've got for extension in Ohio?
Well, the funding mix that we have for extension is federal, state, and county, and the federal part of it is 47%, and the other two are almost equal for the balance of it, state and county. So we have a fairly sizable federal element in our extension program that is federal dollars under the Smith-Lever and the various other types of funding that we get from through the USDA.
Mm-hmm.
But that's roughly somewhere it'll vary a little, 45-47% on federal, and then the other will be somewhere between 25-30% each.
We don't have any county up here. We've got some counties. The equivalent of some areas that could do so. Mm-hmm. One of the best I can think of is Kenai Peninsula. They could do so with, and not bat an eye, but they don't. Now, part of that is familiarization, and part of that they've just recently arrived at that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't need to explain. But that's our situation.
Let's take a 5-minute break and take a cup of coffee, and then we'll have Dr. Peter's presentation.
But don't worry about this state. This state's going to be great, fantastic.
Kelly, this little red light on the recording battery flicks on and off. Do you think that it needs any battery? They were at the store. I guess I could stop it.
There's no wealth being created through the production of new things, and of course agriculture represents one way that we could do that and could help in diversifying Alaska's economic base. Secondly, it can help stabilize food costs through increased food production within the state. At the present time, of course, the Alaskans here know, but we import 95% of all the food we consume and 98% of the red meat that we consume, even though we have substantial potential for producing these commodities. On the other hand, we are a relatively small market in comparison with Ohio, for example. We have 400,000 people in comparison with the million people that, with the 11 million people that Ohio has. And this has implications with respect to just how well we can develop these resources. Third thing is, if we had some agricultural development, we had some job opportunities for Alaskans through the expanded production and food of fiber, as well as the necessary supporting services for agriculture, which is an important thing. And last of all, of course, we could have improved rural and community life through economic benefits from agricultural production. We certainly have some rural areas today in Alaska which are really less than economically sound. Many of them exist primarily through one form or another of welfare programs. And if we could develop more in the way of agricultural industry, even if it's relatively small, for example, in comparison with Ohio, it would help in this last point right here, which is really more of a sociological element than is the than are the first three points, which are really more economic. But just very simply, these are four points, I think, that can really benefit Alaska with agricultural development. But the agricultural development isn't easy. It's not here now, and you saw in Dr. Kopman's presentation the agriculture Alaska has to compete with. The lower 48 has the finest developed agricultural system in the world. And when we start producing commodities here, we've got to compete with that system. We've got to start right out running. We can't kind of, I've heard it said that, well, let's move Alaska's agriculture along slowly so it will kind of crawl before it walks, you know, and then walk before it runs, and then kind of run before it flies. And that's such a good analogy because, after all, we all grew up and we were babies once and we all crawled once, you know, and then we began to walk a little bit and then we began to run, perhaps. And that makes sense to all of us, you see. But it won't work. It won't work as far as the development of our agricultural program is concerned, because we've got to compete with the most fully developed agriculture in the United States, in the world, in fact. And we've just got to move ahead and compete with them right at the outset. So it's going to take a fairly substantial thrust to really move ahead and do the job in that manner. Where do we really stand with respect to Alaska's agricultural research picture? To be very simple, I like to use the triangle. And again, it's a very simple thing, but it helps us look at Alaska's agricultural system and the elements of it. And the important thing is we have to have all three of these elements that are on the sides of the triangle, and without it, the agricultural system in Alaska will simply be a failure. We have tried thrusts towards agricultural development in the past, and in almost every case, those thrusts have emphasized one of the sides of this triangle without all three. And as a result, the thrusts have failed. What? We had a Grain Incentive Act here a few years ago, which was primarily aimed really at the financing aspect of it. It provided money for the sale of the grain. But it did nothing with respect to talking about increasing the production base or increasing the processing and marketing. As a result, nothing happened. And the act expired after its due time. because it simply didn't go all the way. We've had occasional isolated shots at doing something with respect to processing and marketing. Look, the state has financed slaughterhouses in various places within the state. But in financing those slaughterhouses, it did nothing to encourage increased production. It did nothing to encourage increased financing. And so as a result, nothing happened. The slaughterhouses now stand virtually unused. Why? Well, all three elements of the system were not brought together at the same time. And we've got to have all three. That's why when the development project, which is underway at the present time near Delta Junction, was planned, it was designed specifically so that land would be provided for production, but in addition, there would be a processing and marketing phase developed through funding for grain elevators, for grain drying, for marketing overseas, and there would, in addition, be financing established through a state appropriation for increasing the limits of the Agricultural Revolving Loan Fund to provide funds for the farmers to get the job done. Well, now, those are the three elements of the agricultural system, and when you're just starting an agricultural program, the amounts of money that go into those elements are enormous in comparison with other things that you've got to finance, such as the research program. Yet the research program is critical because it's kind of the glue that holds the whole triangle together. If you don't have research that permits you to use the latest in varieties and production techniques that Dr. Cotman was talking about, you're simply not going to compete with those same commodities grown outside. If your production only turns out 15 bushels per acre of rapeseed, and the Canadians right next door to us are turning out 30 bushels of acre per acre of rapeseed because they have a superior variety that we don't have, or a superior cultural practice that we don't have, adapted to our conditions, we can't compete. There's no way. No way we can do it. The same thing is true with respect to the processing and marketing. If we don't have the necessary research to show the very best ways of processing, the best means of transportation, the best cost analysis of getting the job done, then we're not going to be able to compete. And financing is, to an extent, the same way. It requires a certain degree of research to determine what the best means of financing are in order to carry out this entire triangle system. So I think it's important to keep in mind these three elements and remember that initially the costs of these three sides of the triangle are probably going to be substantially more than the research costs. Yet if we don't have the research costs, we're wasting our time spending money on these other three because the whole triangle is not going to hang together. Well, I think the triangle basically expresses something about various elements of this agricultural infrastructure that we've got to have not just in Alaska but in any place. And of course the problem that we talked about a little earlier before we had our coffee break was that this triangle is already fully developed in every other state. In Alaska it's not. And so consequently the programs of those states to support agriculture can concentrate on research. Whereas in our case we've got all three of these things to do. We've got to start right out running. Can't just kind of crawl along a little bit and then gradually walk and then hope to run. We've got to start out running just as fast as we can, or else we're not going to make the grade in competition with other places. Well, what do we have with respect to research locations in Alaska? Well, just a quick map of our locations within the state. As you know, we have our main university campus at Fairbanks. But we have a university campus also at Anchorage and a university campus in Juneau down here. Now, associated with our campus at Fairbanks is an agricultural research center and a research farm. Associated with the Palmer area, about 50 miles from the Anchorage campus, is an agricultural research center and a research farm. And we have a research center at Homer down here on the lower portion of the Kenai Peninsula. So these are the three geographic locations, then, of areas where we carry out research within the state. However, because of needs in other places, for example, the reindeer industry here on the Seward Peninsula, and other areas of work, pipeline revegetation, for example, north of the Brooks Range up in here, we do have various kinds of field research out in different locations within the state in order to meet those particular needs. But our three physical locations are, as we see right here. At the moment, we have no permanent professional staff at Homer. The research program there is run remotely by the professional staff at Palmer and at Fairbanks. How has our program in agriculture changed in Alaska? How has agriculture changed in Alaska just during the past three or four years? And there have been substantial changes. There's been changes in philosophy, there have been changes in the needs for development of agriculture in Alaska, and actual physical changes in the agricultural system within the state. Back in 1976, let's just consider fiscal year 76, for example. Well, at that time, we had somewhere between 17,000 and 20,000 acres of cropland in production. And that included even cropland for introduced forages. Relatively small. The smallest acreage, as a matter of fact, of cultivated land in any state. Rhode Island has some 23,000 acres. And of course, Rhode Island is the smallest state in the United States. The crops that were produced on that land were primarily, maybe 80 acres of vegetables, you know, in the state. Some small grains, some forages. And our research program, as far as production agriculture then, in agronomy and horticulture, was geared and designed toward supporting the needs of that 19,000 acres. Now that didn't include other things, of course, like home gardens, village gardens, greenhouse activity, which is growing, of course, at the present time, and was growing then. But nevertheless, it reflects the relatively small agriculture in Alaska that we had to work with as far as the research program is concerned. We do have a dairy industry in the Matanuska Valley, and our research program at the Palmer Experiment Station here has a